From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is host and managing editor of VOA's Daybreak Africa, James Buddy. Our topic, reimagining U.S. Africa policy under the Biden administration. Our guest, Judd Devermont, director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's an important think tank here in Washington. Judd is no stranger to these VOA microphones. He is a regular panelist on our sister debate format program, Encounter. Prior to joining CSIS, Judd Devermont served as the National Intelligence Officer for Africa from 2015 to 2018. In this position, he led the U.S. intelligence community's analytic efforts on sub-Saharan African issues. From 2013 to 2015, he was the Central Intelligence Agency's senior political analyst on sub-Saharan Africa. Judd Devermont also served as the National Security Council Director for Somalia, Nigeria, the Sahel, and the African Union from 2011 to 2013. In this role, he managed the process that resulted in U.S. recognition of the Somali government for the first time since 1991. Judd spent 2 years abroad working at the U.S. Embassy in Abuja, Nigeria from 2008 to 2010. On this edition of Press Conference USA, James Buddy and I will talk with Judd about his recent paper entitled A New U.S. Policy Framework for the African Century. Analysts say that of all the regions in the world, there is more consensus than divergence between Republican and Democratic administrations regarding U.S. Africa policy. But with the advent of the coronavirus pandemic, which has taken a toll on the continent's economic fortunes, renewed conflict in Ethiopia, backsliding on democratic norms, and the ever-present threat from China's malign influence, there are no shortage of challenges for the Biden administration in Africa. And Judd Devermont joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. Judd, welcome to Press Conference USA.
Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you, James. I'm delighted to be here.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague, host of the popular Daybreak Africa, James Buddy.
Thank you, Carol. And Judd, it's always nice to be with you.
Judd, in your paper on a new U.S. policy framework for the African century, you say, quote, since the end of the Cold War, most U.S. administrations have promoted democracy and governance, peace and security, trade and investment and development. While these priority areas remain important, their strategic significance to broader U.S. goals has become undervalued. The policy process, including its implementation and communication, has consequently become stale in the purview of lower ranking officials. Talk about what you mean by that, what you mean also by the African century.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carol. One of the strengths of U.S. policy towards Africa has been the bipartisan consensus that whether it's President Bush or Clinton or Obama, there's been a shared commitment to focusing on the continent, an embrace of a predecessor's programs, and bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle in Congress. And the point in the piece is that that's fantastic. Having continuity is one of the ways in which we ensure that the implementation is solid and long-lasting. But the piece also makes the point that that can be a break on innovation and creativity. So what I say is bipartisan is fantastic. We need more of that. But perhaps we should challenge the consensus just a little bit and challenge some of the conventions, in part because the continent has changed dramatically in the last 25 years. So if it's a consensus based on a continent in amber, from the mid-1990s, then we have to do some rethinking. And I'm happy to elaborate, Carol, a little bit on where I see the continent changing and then where we need to go in terms of policy.
Please go ahead and give us a sense of the direction you think we should be going.
So first, we have to reframe where the continent is today. It is a demographic powerhouse. By 2015, a population of 1.2 billion will double. Nigeria will be the third largest country in the world, surpassing the United States. It's a region with real global sway, both in the UN Security Council and the General Assembly and other bodies. In the Security Council, African countries have three seats, known as the A3. In the General Assembly, with 54 members. It is the largest voting bloc, and it's typically the most unified voting bloc. It's a continent that is committed to democracy in a time when the rest of the world is in democratic recession. Almost 70% of Africans support democracy. Now, that doesn't mean that the supply is where it should be, but the demand remains consistent. And we have seen really a remarkable set of peaceful transitions of power over the last 6 years. Since 2015, there was 33 peaceful transfers of power, and it will be 34 in late February when Niger completes its election cycle. And finally, maybe because of all of those reasons, it's a continent that's attracting a lot of attention from foreign partners. We talk a lot, obviously, about China, but if we broaden the aperture, we see the Gulf states, UAE, Saudi, Qatar, we see Turkey, we see Japan, South Korea, India. I've counted 150 new embassies that have been built on the continent between 2010 and 2015. And I think the last point here before moving to policy recommendations is we have tend to look at what happens in Africa as if it stays in Africa, you know, that it doesn't leave its shores. But if you zoom out, you see that Africa really does change the way the world works. When there was piracy off the Horn of Africa, that changed the maritime industry. The migration crisis in West Africa has really dramatically changed politics in Europe with the rise of xenophobic and ultra-right parties. When the Ebola outbreak happened, that changed the way we thought about global health, at least until the COVID-19 crisis. But we can also make this argument about positive developments. For example, fintech and mobile money, that came out of East Africa, and now that's a global phenomenon. So if you think about the continent and all of these points, demographically, international influence, its commitment to democracy, even if it's in short supply, the fact that so many actors are engaging on the continent, it says that we have to rethink what we do day to day. And so the point of the paper is that there needs to be a new policy framework. And I would just say there's really three overarching principles. First, we have to treat Africans as strategic partners. We have to engage with our African counterparts because there are important issues on the table. It can't be an afterthought. It can't be, well, let's just have another African come to the Oval Office. We have to elevate African voices in global affairs. It is going to be African voices that are going to make the difference on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It's going to be African voices that are going to be critical in terms of whether or not we can isolate North Korea and the rogue regime's ability to sustain itself through illicit sales. It's going to be African voices that are either going to condemn China's crackdown on democracy protesters in Hong Kong, or they're going to remain silent. So we really do need to think about Africa in this global sense. And then finally, we need to have a real dialogue with Africans about what's happening in our country, what's happening in their country. We need to talk about our failings and our strengths. We need to talk about George Floyd's murder. We need to talk about the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. You know, we have to be not wagging our finger about emulating our model, but rather having a shared dialogue about the challenges we all face. And then one last point that I've done a lot of work on is that we actually have to get outside of the Beltway. And I know VOA is a great example of where many people are listening to this conversation. But too often in Washington, D.C., we talk to each other. And we've done this project called Why Africa Matters to U.S. Cities, where we investigate what the African continent means if you live in Wichita or Boise or Albuquerque or Birmingham. And I think that's really critical because talking about Africa in the traditional Beltway sense about counterterrorism, et cetera, just doesn't resonate with Americans. And so for me, those are some of the biggest sort of framings that I think are critical for our policy. And then I'll bring up some other stuff as we chat.
Sounds great. And also, you certainly defined the African century with all of your points very clearly and vividly. Let me toss it over to James for a question.
Thank you, Kara, and thank you, John, for a beautiful article. For those of us who speak regularly to Africans on the continent, there's no doubt that the Trump administration's America First policy has impacted Africa's view of the United States. Now, while some Africans are still hopeful that the Biden administration can return to what I will call the golden days of U.S.-Africa relations, and as Carol referred to in her opening, some, especially the pessimistic ones, say that Africa is not going to feature prominently in U.S. foreign policy because of shrinking resources brought on by the COVID-19 and the threat to democracy here at home. Can you give our listeners one or two reasons why Africa should be optimistic about U.S.-Africa relations under the Biden administration?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, James. I think there's a number of things that we are going to see the Biden administration do that is a restoration, as you say, of the golden era. There's a couple of things that I think are going to be moving forward, sort of forward-looking. And then I think there are some questions that you rightly point out about sort of what are the limitations on President Biden's time and attention. But we're going to see a revival of a focus on democracy and governance, which was sorely lacking under the Trump administration. Already, we have seen the State Department and the White House speak out about what's happening in Uganda and Ethiopia. Because the Biden administration is committed to multilateralism, that has important effects for African countries, particularly when you're talking about rejoining the WHO or rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. And just the fact that they have nominated, and she's in her confirmation process, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who was an ambassador to Liberia and the assistant secretary of state for Africa. I think those are all good signs. President Biden on day one reversed the travel ban. That's a very good news if you're a Nigerian, an Eritrean, a Tanzanian, a Somali, or a Sudanese who had been under that travel ban. And this is a president that is focused on COVID and focused on climate change. Those are all things that I think suggest a positive Africa policy. But that's not just about, as I said, turning the page back to Obama or Bush. You know, what President Biden is talking about is greater engagement with the U.S. diaspora. And you can just see, particularly the number of Nigerian Americans that are in very senior positions in this government, as a good sign. And what I'm thrilled about is that he is committed, at least during the campaign, to do an urbanization project, which for me, this is the big transformation for Africa. And too often, the way that American officials have thought about Africa is rural or agricultural, and that Biden's commitment to think about an urbanization initiative is a really exciting prospect, although I think time will tell what that actually looks like. I do have the same questions that you do, James, about how much time and attention he's going to have, considering this president faces more challenges than anyone starting since the Depression. I think that this president, this is a good thing actually, is not sure what he's going to do on security engagement. And so we'll have to see how that sort of pans out. And then finally, not clear exactly what the president thinks about some of the Trump initiatives on economics, whether it's the FTA with Kenya, Prosper Africa, the DFC. These were all good things. And even though the Trump administration, I think, has on balance gets an F on Africa policy, the economic programs are important. And I'm waiting to see whether President Biden will commit to those.
On a practical level, although Africa did not feature prominently in the Trump administration, the few times that Africa was featured, a lot was done that some analysts say the Biden administration might have to repair immediately. Let's take the issues of Western Sahara and Morocco's sovereignty and the issue of Jerusalem. What do you think can the Biden administration do?
Well, the easier answer is for Jerusalem, which I believe that Secretary Blinken said that he was not going to reverse that decision. Nine African states, by the way, either abstained or voted in support of the moving of the capital to Jerusalem, but that's a small minority out of 54 countries. But I think that's pretty settled. On Western Sahara, I think time will tell. The decision to recognize Morocco's control sovereignty over Western Sahara is not going to go down well and has not gone down well with the African Union, where Western Sahara is a member state. Across the continent, it's a little different, though, because Morocco has made a lot of headway with African governments, particularly in West Africa, to recognize its sovereignty over Western Sahara. That has not been the case, particularly in Southern Africa. And so I'm not sure what the Biden administration is going to be able to do with this. They're going to have to think about its relationships with the other countries on the continent, particularly South Africa or Algeria, but also its relationship with Morocco. I should note, by the way, that Israel doesn't recognize Morocco's control over Western Sahara. So that's an interesting wrinkle to think about.
On the longstanding U.S. goals to advance democracy and governance, you make reference to that. What is your recommendation for the Biden administration, how to address the issue of democracy and good governance? Do you think this will be a hard sell, given the events of January 6th at Capitol Building here in Washington?
James, I think that the last 4 years under President Trump and the insurrection is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for Americans and U.S. diplomats to talk honestly about our challenges. And I would add in here also our own divisions, particularly after the several police killings of African Americans. And so I think that there is a conversation about democracy and governance that can be done quite effectively, where we talk to countries about their challenges and we talk about our challenges and we encourage them to raise questions. We have this series at CSIS called Africa Reacts. We just published our 8th edition, where we ask African thought leaders to share their thoughts on the primaries, the inauguration, the election, George Floyd's murder. We had them talk about President Trump's COVID diagnosis. And I think that's the way forward, is a dialogue. But I think that the Biden team has already shown that they're going to talk about democracy and governance, given some of the statements they've made about Uganda, for example. And I think some African governments are not going to be thrilled about that. What I would like to see them do is twofold. First of all, unfortunately, sometimes under previous administrations, we've sort of sorted African countries into good and bad very quickly, right? So a country that is good, Ghana, Senegal, a country that is not so good, Zimbabwe, and those have become sort of static. And I think that what a more accurate conversation would be is to note that all of these countries have strengths and weaknesses, that at the same time that Senegal is a vibrant democracy, President Sall disqualified two of his major candidates in the last election. And we should be able to talk about what's happening in Senegal, regardless of a categorization around the strength of its democracy, because the strength of our democracy has a lot of good and bad. The second thing that I would like to see is President Biden has committed to having a summit for democracy. There's not many details on this yet. I hope to see Africans in a significant role at this event, both African leaders, African civil society, African opposition, and I would like them to not just be compartmentalized to African issues. I want Africans to be engaged on what's happening in Hong Kong. I want Africans to talk about xenophobia in Europe. I want partnerships to come out of that between African and non-African countries on issues of shared concern, perhaps around press freedoms. And I think that's a great first opportunity to reimagine that relationship so it's both global but also local around democracy and governance issues.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Judd Devermont, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a prominent think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa, James Butte. We're discussing prospects for U.S.-Africa policy under the Biden administration. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a very loyal fan, Alhaji Ali Bello from Maiduguri, Borno State in the mighty Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Judd Devermont, director of the Africa Program at CSIS. Judd, we've really enjoyed your conversation so far. I'd like you to make a comment on what the U.S. Congress can do to advance U.S.-Africa policy. We know that foreign policy is usually the province of the executive branch, but now that the Democrats are in control not only of the House of Representatives, but also the Senate, to what extent could that make a difference? That is, you know, this unified government, to what extent could that make a difference in our approach to Africa?
I think it's important, but as we noted earlier, Carol, that there are many Republicans who are committed to Africa and work really well across the aisle on African issues. So I think that having the Democrats in control is important because it means that what happens in the House and the Senate and the White House will work all together. But again, I just don't want to undercut that that's happened in the past when there has been a divided legislature or Republicans, Democrats in different parts of the executive and the legislative branch. But we've got Congressman Meeks, who is now the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He's going to be a strong advocate on African issues. We've hosted him now twice to talk about his Africa policy. Senator Menendez will take over the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has been long engaged on African issues. So I think that's all positive. But what we need to see from Congress is really working with the executive branch to codify executive actions and to bolster budgets. I think that's really important, whether it's power Empower Africa or AGOA, these initiatives that either started in the executive branch or sort of mutually developed between the two branches, that's what gives them longevity. So that's one thing that I'd like to see Congress do, and I think that will be really positive. The other one is to continue to use its oversight functions, even if you're on the same side, right? Take the Biden team to task, ask hard questions, look at the budget. That's a strength of our democracy, is that the legislative branch will have hearings and review what the executive branch is doing, and then hopefully they collaborate to have a better policy together.
Let's pivot to China, Judd. You say in the paper that African leaders have, quote, deplored what they regard as neglectful, mean-spirited, and China-obsessed U.S. foreign policy. Now, I assume the mean-spirited probably refers to unfortunate choice of words by former President Trump, but talk more about what is perceived as the China obsession. What do they mean by that? What do you mean by that? And how should the United States modify its approach to China's growing influence in Africa?
You know, the Trump administration deserves credit for identifying China as a challenge for U.S. interest. And I share some of their concerns about Chinese investments in technology or in ports or in other critical infrastructure, what that means for both African sovereignty and U.S. interest. But the way that the Trump administration did this meant that they didn't have an Africa policy, they had a China policy. As many analysts like to point out, that when former National Security Advisor John Bolton introduced the Africa strategy, he mentioned China 12 to 14 times, and he didn't mention very few African countries even. Since then, the position that they have put Africans in is to don't choose China, but there isn't really an American alternative in certain sectors. And so it left Africans a little bit in the lurch. They felt like this was a zero-sum proposition. And while they want to work with the U.S., and the U.S., according to polling, is more popular as a model than China is, there really wasn't enough to back it up. So I think under the Biden administration, we will see the U.S. government focus on its strengths and not what it's against when it comes to China. There will be a focus clearly on the strategic threats that China poses. But I also think that they will work to build an U.S. alternative in many sectors, to work multilaterally so that if it's not a U.S. company, perhaps it's a UAE or Turkish or French company. That's particularly important in the infrastructure space. And then I think that they will look for opportunities to cooperate with China when necessary. And this is something that Secretary Blinken said in his confirmation hearings, that China was a strategic adversary, but we need to work with them on limited amounts of issues such as climate change and the COVID-19 response. So in our piece, we talked about constructive competition. How do we compete with China in a way that isn't off-putting to the Africans, that recognizes the Africans' needs, that helps provide tools for Africans to evaluate some of this debt, to do a better job in pushing back on any of the environmental degradation posed by Beijing? And the Africans are doing that. And the African institutions, such as the African Development Bank, has barred several Chinese companies for fraud and corruption. So I think that there's the ability to do this. What I'd like to see from the Africans is being more explicit about what they want in their partnerships, both from us and from the Chinese. What are the levels of transparency, accountability, the standards that they want? And then we can all abide by that. So that's where I think the future is of the China-Africa-U.S. relationship.
Let me turn to my colleague James for another question.
The issue of corruption used to feature prominently in U.S. foreign policy. In fact, I was just reading the 2020 Transparency International Corruption Index, and many African countries did poorly. What do you think the Biden administration can do? Do you think it should return to previous U.S. policy that made corruption a part of the good governance policy?
I do think that they should return corruption to the good governance policy, in part because we know that many Africans are frustrated by the corruption in their societies and how that limits their ability to care for their families and to succeed in their careers. I think there's a couple of things that we have to do. First of all, let's not make this just an African issue. I don't think the Biden team will. And let's recognize that corruption is one of the factors that deters U.S. investment, but not all of the factors. Two, as much as I like Transparency International as an organization, it's not the most methodologically sound approach to measuring corruption. As it says, it's a perceptions index. So if there is a big scandal in Angola, Angola next year will move up the scale. So I think we have to work internally on measurements. And then And I think that's probably the best place to start is to, this is a global policy. We're going to work to find better ways to indices and to measure this. And then we're going to work with African countries that are interested in it and civil societies to address these issues. And thinking about corruption, not just as an economic problem, but as a governance problem, but also as a security problem. If you look at what's happening in Northeast Nigeria, one of the challenges is the way the Nigerian military asks for bribes, gets contracts that really gums up the ability of humanitarian agencies to access vulnerable populations. So I think we have to have this global perspective and all of the dimensions of what corruption means in terms of inhibiting peace and prosperity on the continent.
And talking about security, conflicts continue to flare up in Africa. We have the conflict in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, conflicts all over. Do you think putting out these fires should be the responsibility of Africa prominently, or there's something that the Biden administration can do to help put out these fires?
Well, I think, James, the responsibility is first and foremost the Africans. And one of the things that I highlight in this piece is just the growth in many of the multilateral organizations on the continent, from the African Union to the G5 Sahel. I think those are all really positive developments. The U.S. government and Africa's international partners can be very helpful here in terms of capacity building. I suspect there'll be a new conversation about U.N. financing of AU peacekeeping missions. That's important. The one thing that the U.S. is very good at and didn't do enough of or at all under the Trump administration is being a convener. And I think the example of what's happening in Tigray, we need to have a global, Africa's partners, those who care about what's happening in the Horn of Africa, need to come together and address what this terrible crisis means for Ethiopians, for the region, for the broader globe, with 100,000 Ethiopian refugees now in Sudan, with more than 1 million displaced people out of Tigray, with Eritrea sending troops into Ethiopia, allegations that Somalis are also fighting, a border flare-up with Sudan. This requires, and I think the U.S. is particularly positioned to do this, to bring everyone together to the table to address access issues for the humanitarian organizations and also to work towards brokering a peace deal and then holding people accountable for human rights abuses.
The issue of COVID-19 and the vaccine, there's disparity between poor countries and the more wealthy countries. How do you think Africa can handle this issue of the COVID-19 vaccine and making sure that most poor African countries can gain access to this vaccine?
First positive story is that U.S. has rejoined the WHO, which means they'll contribute to COVAX, which is the WHO-supported vaccine. That's good news to begin with. But as you mentioned, James, there is a disparity. And I saw President Ramaphosa of South Africa had just raised this issue. A number of really important people, former leaders such as Ellen Sirleaf Johnson and Mo Ibrahim, the Sudanese business person, have just raised this issue as well, that there is a disparity, that there is hoarding, and this vaccine nationalism is a problem. One of the things, James, that we looked at prior to the vaccine was just on COVID response. We counted 24 countries that are giving support to African countries on COVID-19. So we're talking about PPEs or medicine or ventilators, et cetera. And it wasn't coordinated. It was all done bilaterally. I have a suspicion that it's led to some corruption by different countries, like in Zimbabwe, there was a story about that, in Nigeria. And I think some of the quality wasn't good. Minister Kagwe, the health minister of Kenya, pointed out that the PPEs from Kenya were deficient. And so when we move to vaccines, we have to correct what was wrong about the initial response, which is it was all fragmented and fractured. How do we get together? India's already stepping up and providing vaccines, Mauritius and Seychelles, and then selling it to South Africa. But the U.S. can be a key partner here in terms of having a global conversation to make sure that we address this. As the head of the African WHO has said, either we all are vaccine or none of us are, right? If we either we all get through this or we don't get through this. So I think that's got to be in the back of our mind throughout this process.
Judd Devermont is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Judd, thanks so much for sharing your insights and hopes for U.S.-Africa policy going forward.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was James Buddy, host and managing editor of Daybreak Africa. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.